I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation about memory. Why does one woman remember every moment of the last 35 years? Another man forgets everything he knows every 20 seconds of every day. But first, police in Slovakia are saying today that the radioactive material they seized yesterday is enriched uranium, not enough to make a nuclear bomb, but enough to make a dirty bomb that could wreak havoc. Authorities arrested three men yesterday, Hungarian and Ukrainian, saying that they were on their way to sell nuclear material. The arrests have raised new alarms over the smuggling of nuclear materials. And for the latest, we turn to Jan Lopatka, senior correspondent in Prague for Reuters News. Jan, do we know how much of this enriched uranium these three men were trying to sell and who they were trying to sell it to?
They had about half a kilo of the uranium, and they were arrested on their way to a meeting where they were supposed to sell the material. But the police did not say who the buyers were because the buyers did not show up at the meeting.
And we understand that the men were trying to sell it for a huge sum of money?
Yes, police said they were trying to sell it for about $1.7 million in total, or $3,500 per gram.
Today, the police are saying that the material that was found was enriched enough to be used in a radiological dirty bomb. Now, this would be a bomb where radioactive material is added to a conventional explosive. It's not said to incur high casualties, but it would still wreak a lot of havoc and spread a lot of fear. They say enriched enough. Do we know what they mean by that?
The police were not specific at all about the level of enrichment of the uranium found. And we have spoken to some experts on nuclear issues, and they said that a low enriched uranium would not really be very harmful if it was used. So we are still not clear on how dangerous this material actually was if it ended up in the hands of terrorists.
Yeah. Well, the International Atomic Energy Agency has said that they are trying to contact Hungarian and Slovak authorities to get more information. Is that unusual, that this was a pretty much strictly a police operation? It didn't seem to have international, atomic energy specialists involved.
What we do know is that the Slovak police cooperated with the Hungarian police. And I would believe that in a case like this, the Secret Service and, you know, the various government agencies would get involved as well. But we haven't heard any specific information on that. However, these countries do report such incidents to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which keeps a track record of anything such happening.
Yeah. Do we know how these men were carrying the uranium? We remember in a sting planned by the CIA and the Republic of Georgia, a Russian man was arrested with weapons-grade uranium. He was just carrying it in a little plastic bag in his coat pocket. Do we know how these men were carrying it?
All we know is that it was a powder, and it was in two tube-shaped containers, but that's about all.
Do we know where the material came from? We've read that Swedish and Russian experts just released a secret report that's said to have exposed gaping holes in securing nuclear materials, especially in northwest Russia.
Well, the Slovak police said that they believed it did come from the former Soviet Union, but they did not say if it was from Russia or specifically. But the place where it was seized is close to the border with Ukraine, and experts say Ukraine was one of the main places in the Soviet Union for fuel processing, and security standards there are not very high until today.
How are people in the area reacting to this?
Well, it's not the first case here. About 13 years ago, Czech police found almost 3 kilos of very highly enriched uranium in Prague, actually in downtown Prague, and that was one of the biggest cases ever after another case in Russia in the same year. And, you know, there was no big panic even back then. So the Czechs don't feel threatened by terrorism very much because they haven't experienced any big terrorist attack in Prague or anywhere else in the country. So the fear is not big.
Jan Lopatka, senior correspondent for Reuters News, speaking to us from Prague about the news that two Hungarians and one Ukrainian have been arrested, allegedly in possession of half a kilogram of nuclear material. Jan, thanks for speaking with us.
Bye, Robin. Thanks.
Our conversation today is about the mystery of memory. A memory researcher at the University of Oregon had graduate students keep forgetting diaries, and he calculates that we all, no matter what age, squander a month a year compensating for time we spent forgetting, 15 minutes here and there looking for lost keys or a phone number. Why does that happen? And can memory be improved? Daniel Schachter is professor of psychology at Harvard University. He's also the author of Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past, among other books. And he was featured in a fascinating article about memory in this month's National Geographic magazine. He joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, I want to just get one thing clear. We all know that memory starts to fail as you get older, and we'll talk about why, but you know, memory issues can, you know, the kind of things we're going to talk about can happen with younger people as well.
Memory issues happen to people at all ages for different reasons, but we're all subject to various of memory's foibles and frailties.
Right. And some are extreme. In the National Geographic article, two people were profiled. There was a 41-year-old called AJ who remembers almost every single moment of her life from the age of 11. Extraordinary. And an 85-year-old called EP, who can hold on to something that you tell him for just a few seconds and then it's gone. AJ, for instance, who can remember what happened on the TV show Murphy Brown on December 12th, 1988. Is that possible?
She is someone who is obsessed with her past. She keeps a diary of everything that happens to her, and she records the dates and she records the events and obsessively reviews them. And as a result, she has this extraordinary kind of uncontrollable memory for her past and experiences her past in a way that few of us do.
Well, she would say, first of all, she's not a savant like Utah's Kim Peek, who was the subject of Rain Man. He's memorized 12,000 books. She says she first noticed this when she was a kid, that before she started, you know, kind of reviewing her life, it just came up to her.
She's not an extraordinary memorizer.
Right.
She does pretty well on standard memory tests, but nothing extraordinary.
Right.
And in fact, in the original paper that reported her case, the investigators asked her about some events that had happened a month earlier when they had been testing her, because you might come to the conclusion that her memory works kind of like a video recorder.
Right.
But it doesn't at all. She actually had pretty sketchy memory for what they said and did when they asked her about this videotape session.
Right.
So with her, the question is, why is she so focused on the past?
Right.
Why? What accounts for this kind of uncontrollable obsession with the past?
She could be brushing her teeth on November 10th, 2007, and review the last 20 November 10ths in her life. Apparently, they had to come up with a special name for her: hyperthymestic syndrome.
It's as if she's stuck kind of in what psychologists call retrieval mode, which is something most of us go into every now and then when we want to recollect and or relive our past. Her life is pretty much spent doing
stuck
that.
Stuck there. Well, keep her in mind because she's one end of the sort of the memory spectrum, and maybe something people would like to achieve, have a little more memory of their past. EP, on the other hand, at the other end, the 85-year-old, you know, he can't remember that he had breakfast, so he has it again. I mean, he can remember skills, like he knows why we cook and he knows how to walk, but we could have a conversation with him and 30 seconds later, he's cheerful about you, but he doesn't remember you.
EP is a severe case of a syndrome that's called the amnesic syndrome. Basically, it happens when there's damage to a key part of the brain known as the hippocampus and some structures nearby it in the inner part of the temporal lobe. And EP, about 15 years ago, unfortunately had a case of viral encephalitis that selectively attacked these parts of the brain that are crucial for making new memories. They knock them out, but not much else. As a result, he still has a pretty high IQ. In casual conversation, he would probably seem pretty normal to you, but he can't hold on to memories for more than a couple of seconds.
Unbelievable. Walks around the block several times, knows that the people seem friendly, so he's friendly back. They've, of course, seen him every day. Well, he has anterograde
amnesia. That's the term for a failure to create new memories that you can consciously recall at a later time. He also has some retrograde amnesia, which means that he has problems recalling some things that happened prior to when he contracted encephalitis back in the early 90s.
Right.
But he does have pretty intact memory for his childhood. There are parts of the brain that were undamaged by the encephalitis and that seem to be kind of the repository of very old memories.
Well, that leads us to what it is that we're talking about, this thing called memory, because what he tells us, in addition to being fascinating, EP reminds us there are parts, and if you're missing a part, you won't have a certain kind of memory. So, you know, what is memory, first of all?
In general terms, it's our ability to create, retain, and retrieve information about our past. But one of the critical lessons that we've learned over the last 20 years is that memory is not a single thing, which we used to think it was. There are a variety of different forms of memory or memory systems. And what cases like EP teach us is that these systems can be damaged selectively so that you could have essentially no memory for his recent experiences, and yet normal ability, for example, to learn new skills. He can acquire new motor skills and show various non-conscious or implicit kinds of memory. He can be affected by his experience in a way that would influence him at a later time, but he can't consciously recall what those experiences are.
But can you see memory? I mean, we understand it's a stored pattern of connections formed by the brain's neurons or nerve cells, and that there's, you know, synaptic connections between them. Can you see that? Can you look in, you know, to a brain and say, oh, look, there's, you know, millions of neurons connected. That's
You can't memory. See a memory in the sense that you can't look into a brain and say there's the memory in that neuron or in that group of neurons. But what you can do with the modern neuroimaging techniques is you can look into the brain of healthy people and people with memory disorders, and you can see very precisely which parts of the brain become active when you encode or create a new memory, when you retrieve an old memory, when you retrieve a recent memory. That we can do, and we've learned a lot about memory by looking at what parts of the brain become active when we encode and retrieve experiences.
Mm. Well, we understand that a lot of what we know about memory comes from an 81-year-old in Connecticut who had epilepsy. A doctor did surgery on him decades ago. It reduced his seizures, but removed part of his brain, and he's become the most studied patient, apparently, in the history of brain science. So what was removed, and what did that teach us?
That's patient HM you're referring to. And in the early 50s, at a time when surgeons and neuroscientists didn't realize that the hippocampus was important for memory, they took out the hippocampus and some other nearby structures in his temporal lobe and were shocked to learn that doing so basically eliminated his ability to create new memories. So HM was very important because that was really the first evidence specifically linking the hippocampus and related parts of the temporal lobe to memory.
That's Daniel Schachter, professor of psychology at Harvard University, one of several researchers trying to learn from people who, like that woman AJ, remember everything, or like HM we were just speaking of, or EP, remember nothing. Daniel Schachter is featured in an article in National Geographic that reminds us before the written word, memory was prized. A famous Roman could recite Virgil by heart backwards. But today we have computers and calculators and post-it notes, maybe one reason why our memories are so bad. Will drugs that are in the pipeline help? We'll take a look at that. But speaking of which, later, author Rick Moody has written a story about survivors of an apocalypse who turn to a memory drug. We'll have that story as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Daniel Schachter, professor of psychology and a memory expert at Harvard University. He's included in an article about memory in this month's National Geographic, which asks fascinating questions such as, will we one day be able to regenerate lost brain function? Rockefeller University researchers studying parakeets who are able to generate new neurons to replace brain cells when they're learning new songs, for instance. But back to human memory. How much is human memory a science? How much is psychology? How much is overload? Dr. Schachter, you've said there's no evidence that the brain is physically overloaded, but that we may not want to hear cues that prompt memory. You have something called the seven sins of memory. Tick through those for us.
These are different ways in which memory can kind of break down and get us into trouble. Three of them have to do with forgetting. Transience refers to the fact that as time passes, information tends to become more inaccessible, and that's one major source of forgetting. Absent-mindedness refers to those cases we all know when we fail to pay attention, and that's the cause of forgetting.
You give the example of Yo-Yo Ma leaving his $2.5 million cello in the back of a taxi.
That's right. That's one of the more extreme examples. Yes. But that would be a case of absent-mindedness. He knew perfectly well where that cello was. He just wasn't attending to the cues or attending to the need to remember. The third memory sin I call blocking, and that basically refers to the tip of the tongue experience. The information's there, we're paying attention, but we can't get access to it at the moment. Then there are three more that have to do with different kinds of memory distortions. I call them misattribution, suggestibility, and bias. And they all describe different ways in which we may misremember the past, where our memories may be present but wrong. And then the final sin I call persistence, and that is when we have traumatic or upsetting experiences that kind of take hold of us and we can't get those persisting memories out of our mind no matter how hard we try.
Right. How do you know when, if you start to lose your memory, how do you know that it's not just a part of being overloaded and just not having the right cues and being overwhelmed and you just can't get at the information? And when it is your brain actually atrophying, there's, you know, pictures in National Geographic of what the brain looks like in an Alzheimer's patient, and there's, you know, large dark holes where a certain brain function would be. How do you know which is which?
It's a very difficult distinction to make because we do expect some impairment of memory with normal aging, and the line between that and a condition like Alzheimer's is not easy to define, particularly in the early stages of the condition. If the memory impairment is such that one actually cannot function normally, if it's so persistent and severe that one can no longer carry out one's, you know, work, or one is really impaired in functioning around the home, then it's likely that it's something more than a normal kind of forgetting process that you can typically get around by giving yourself reminders and other kinds of aids that help you navigate around a memory problem.
If it turns out to be that your brain is actually, you know, being eaten away, is it worth knowing that? Because can you stop that?
There's no known cure, for example, for Alzheimer's disease. Now, people are working on various drug therapies. There are possibly some interventions that can slow the disease down, but none that can reverse it. But yeah, it is important to know because certainly for caregivers and family members, it can help you to plan and understand what likely lies ahead. If it's not something like Alzheimer's disease, it may be depression or something else that's going on. It's important to know that, too.
Well, if it's just that your memory isn't where you want it to be, can you rejigger it? I mean, we read about a school in the South Bronx that has started kids doing card games, you know, memorizing cards to improve their academics, and it did. There's other kinds of mnemonics, you know, just techniques for preserving memory. Do they work?
They work to some extent. You know, one of the first points to realize is that what approach you adopt to improving your memory very much depends on which of the memory sins, in my terminology, you want to address. So, for example, to overcome transience, that is the fading of information over time, mnemonics can be very useful.
And some of these techniques are things called memory palaces. What is that?
A memory palace is basically is a form of mnemonics where you're creating vivid visual images. And the reason they refer to them as memory palaces would be that, you know, going back to Greek times when these techniques were first created, a mnemonic technique might involve creating a vivid visual image of something you want to remember and then putting it into a mental palace, a layout that you know well.
Like an architectural memory.
An architectural, imagined architectural building. And so if you want to remember that you have to pick up bread at the grocery store, you mentally put the loaf of bread in a room in your memory palace in your mind. And then when you get to the store, you bring up the palace and say, what's in that, you know, what's in that room on the top floor?
You mentioned new drugs. We read about amphikines, which would facilitate the transmission of glutamate and the synapses that we spoke of. And, you know, these are all in the pipeline, which means that, you know, probably there will be something. As a researcher in memory, do you think that's a good idea that we might someday pop a pill and retain all memories?
At first, we might all say, yeah, I mean, that would be great. It would be a wonderful thing if I could just take a pill and overcome all my memory problems. But on the other hand, there's some tricky issues about would a pill that increased your retentiveness might also increase your susceptibility to unwanted memories. Another issue is, you know, deciding on who gets access to such memory pills, if they would be helpful, for example, in school. Should all school kids be getting them? Should only some?
Should any?
Should any be getting them? It's a very tricky issue. It's already come up with drugs that might be helpful in kind of taking some of the sting out of traumatic memories. But again, some have raised the issue, well, maybe there's a reason why those traumatic memories have that sting and why you need to work through them. And perhaps, you know, taking a pill that makes those memories easier to live with might prevent you from dealing with them in a way that you need to in order to eventually put them to rest. So I think it's a more complex issue than many people at first might think.
As is memory. Daniel Schachter, professor of psychology at Harvard University, also author of Searching for Memory, The Brain, the Mind, and the Past, and The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. He has other books as well. And also he was included in an article about memory in this month's National Geographic magazine. We can link you to that at our website, here-now.org. Fascinating. Professor Schachter, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead, a new report shows that it's taking longer than ever to process veterans' disability claims. We'll take a closer look. Back after the news, here and now. A new report shows that the Department of Veterans Affairs is taking longer than ever to process disability claims, that its backlog of cases is growing, and that the time the agency allows workers to process an appeal has nearly doubled to 675 days. That means a veteran who initially gets turned down for disability payments could wait a couple of years to have his case appealed. Chris Adams is an investigative reporter for McClatchy Newspapers in Washington. He's been writing about the new information in the VA's annual report for Congress, which lays out the long and short-term goals for the agency. And Chris, the headline seems to be that the VA is losing ground.
Yes, I mean, I think the last 4 or 5 years, the VA has essentially been stuck in place. On some measures, they've lost ground. They set aggressive goals for themselves, or they set goals for themselves every year, and every year, year after year, they basically don't make any progress toward actually achieving those goals. And on some of these pivotal measures are actually getting worse year to year to year.
Well, let's give some numbers. For instance, the report says on average it takes 183 days to process a claim. The goal is 160 days. It's much longer than that, and much longer than the long-term goal of 125 days. So what does this mean for veterans? Do they just have to wait for, you know, treatment as they wait for their claim to be processed?
Correct. This number deals with disability payment system. So a veteran who's been disabled in war files to get monthly disability payments, puts in a claim to the VA, and they wait, on average, 183 days. That means a lot of them are waiting much longer than that. A lot of them are waiting 9 months or 12 months or even longer to get the initial decision on their claim. At one time, 4 or 5 years ago, the VA actually said, we want to process these claims in 90 days, or then 100 days, and then 125 days. And for the last 4 or 5 years, they've basically gotten a little bit worse every year instead of actually making progress toward getting down to this 100-day goal that they once had or this 125-day goal that they have right now.
Right. And so they've been sort of moving the goalposts further back on the goals and still not making the goals.
Correct.
Put this in context for us. Who are we talking about here? Are these veterans who are not active duty anymore?
Right. These are people who are not active duty anymore. Roughly somewhere between 3 and 3.5 million veterans get disability payments every month. The vast majority of those are the older veterans. Guys from Vietnam is probably the biggest block, although there's still a big block from World War II and Korea, although those people are dying off every year. But Vietnam veterans are increasing in numbers because those guys are hitting 60 and 65, and their disabilities that may have been slight, you know, when they're in their 20s and 30s are becoming more pronounced.
Huh.
And then the fastest growing segment, although it's still a small share overall, are the Iraq and Afghanistan vets who are coming back in the last couple of years. They've been putting in their claims for the last 2 years, and their numbers are starting to grow, although they're still, you know, a small share of the overall VA disability total.
Well, that's fascinating, because I was going to ask if, in fact, part of this huge backlog is that there's a huge wave of Iraq and Afghan veterans, but you're saying, no, the huge wave is Vietnam veterans who are getting older and having more disabilities.
Right. I mean, all of that, there were more than 800,000 claims filed last year. Some of those are brand-new claims, a veteran filing for the first time. Some of those are an older veteran who's already getting disability payments filing because their condition has gotten worse, so they've gotten a new new service-related condition. And so the number of claims is going up. The complexity of the claims is going up. When a veteran is filing these days, they might be filing for 5 or 6 or 7 different issues, whereas, you know, before, a long time ago, they might have filed for 1 or 2. So there's more claims. There's more complex claims. There's this surge of Iraq claims that are coming. coming in. At the same time, they're dealing with this much bigger cohort of the Vietnam veterans.
Hmm. And well, that's claims, but you also write about appeals, and that's a number that really jumped out at us. This is, you know, when the claim is turned down. The agency had a goal of 365 days processing these appeals, but we understand the average processing time this year was 660 days.
Correct.
Tell us more about that.
Well, the appeals process, if I'm a veteran, I file to get disability and I'm denied in whole or in part, I can file an appeal. It goes through this long process. It goes through this division within the VA called the Board of Veterans Appeals. It takes a long, long time. An appeal bounces back and forth. It gets sent to the appeals board. It gets sent back to the local office. It goes back to the appeals board, back to the local office. And there are many veterans that I've written about over the years who are literally waiting 4 or 5 or 6 years to get their appeal eventually decided.
Well, so what happens to those veterans while they wait?
If they eventually win, they get some of their payments made retroactively. So if they actually end up prevailing, they'll get some of the back money paid to them. But in the meantime, they're missing out. I mean, that is probably current income they would like to have. A lot of older veterans die while they wait. These are the older guys, the World War II guys. If they have a claim that's around for 4 or 5 years, many of them are dying. A couple of years ago, we did a story that showed that more than 13,000 veterans who had died in the previous few years waiting for their appeal to be decided.
And by the way, when it comes to appeals, we said that they used to have the goal of 365 days. Now the average processing time is 660 days. But they can claim to meet their current goal because they moved the goal to 675 days. So, you know, the
correct.
Average is,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, the average is 660 that it's being processed, but the new goal is 675.
Right. And before I wrote the story, I actually did not get an answer from the VA about why they changed that goal.
Chris Adams, I'm wondering, you know, you've said that the Iraq and Afghan veterans are really a small number of what the Department of Veterans is having to deal with. The largest number is Vietnam and still World War II vets. But still, you know, is it perhaps fair to say that nobody expected to have the number of injured veterans that the conflicts have produced? And certainly some of those injuries, brain injuries, for example, the military is, you know, saying they're just not prepared to deal with this new injury that's coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. Is it possible that even though that's a small number, that was sort of the tipping point for the agency?
It's part of it, and it is difficult for them to accurately estimate how many claims might be coming in on a particular year. The bottom line is that they've been understaffed for several years, and so they've allowed this big backlog to build up, and only recently are they actually adding enough people to handle all of these claims. If they'd boosted their staffing a few years ago, we might not have processing times getting longer and we might not have the backlog getting bigger.
Well, and the VA says that they've just recently hired 1,000 people to help process these claims, but it takes 2 or 3 years for those people to be trained to be up to speed.
Correct.
So what's the big picture here? I mean, do you think, you know, something will be done to speed up the process?
Things are getting put in place to get something done. I think there's been an enormous amount of attention on veterans this year and new money from Congress, new promises from the administration to make things run smoother, to make the health system better, to make the disability system better. So it's the kind of thing that it might take a few years for those changes to really kick in. Hopefully in a year or two, they actually will be able to start reaching their goals. On the other hand, they've been setting these goals and promising to meet them a year or two down the road for several years now, and they're not getting any closer for the most part.
Chris Adams, investigative reporter from McClatchy Newspapers in Washington, speaking about the annual report that the Department of Veterans Affairs prepares for Congress. Chris, thanks so much.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, is your hybrid car less fuel efficient than you think? That's tomorrow. And further down the road, we're going to ask the question, should people be able to buy and sell kidneys to meet the demand? A policy analyst is proposing that. You're listening to Here and Now. Remember the deck of playing cards with images of the most wanted members of Saddam Hussein's regime? The U.S. military passed the cards out to troops so they'd know who they were looking for after the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Well, now there's a new set of cards with a new message, promoting cultural sensitivity to antiquities and people in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dr. James Zeidler is a senior research scientist at Colorado State University, which is based at Fort Collins. He worked with a graphic artist to develop this new deck of cards at the request of the Army. Dr. Zeidler, describe the cards for us.
Well, there's a series of cards that are strictly educational, imparting basic information about the archaeology and history of Iraq and Afghanistan. There's many cards that show very attractive pictures of quite famous artifacts from the Iraq area. And now those are just simply in there to give basic information to the troops about the surroundings that they're operating in, both with respect to the sites themselves and the nature of the artifacts that have been found at those sites. Perhaps the majority of the cards have shots of soldiers or the military doing routine activities in Iraq, and there will be captions on there regarding recommended do's and don'ts with respect to cultural heritage resources.
Give us some examples.
Well, there's a shot of a helicopter with a couple of troops standing in front of it, and the helicopter pilot is standing, explaining something with a map to his officer in charge, and the caption says, "Report to your officer in charge any looting activity or attempts to sell ancient artifacts."
So it seems that the goal of the cards is to make troops more aware of the culture of the peoples in Iraq and Afghanistan and of the antiquities so that they don't get destroyed or looted, and of the people so that they can get better information. I'm looking at the Jack of Hearts.
Right.
It's got a picture of older men with head coverings, you know, the picture we're used to seeing. And it
sure
says, "Local elders may be a good source of information about cultural heritage and archaeology." In other words, go to them
right
and ask them.
Right.
You know, both conflicts are several years in. Some people might say, geez, this is coming a little late in the game. You know?
Well, to a certain extent, they have a point. But it was a question of Lori, Dr. Rush, pondering this for a while. And she is the cultural resources manager stationed at Fort Drum, so she's not directly involved in either of those conflicts.
Yes, Lori Rush is really sort of like the archaeologist in residence at Fort Drum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so her involvement is with protecting the cultural resources at Fort Drum and watching troops train there. So the idea came to her a little bit slowly in terms of how to get funding. And what we're trying to do, apart from just applying this to situations in Iraq and Afghanistan, is to really establish a more institutionalized training program on cultural heritage awareness within the Department of Defense.
Right.
So that in the future it will take off and be applied no matter where American troops are deployed, both for training and for actual operations.
Ahead of the fact. Well, you're working on a website about cultural heritage preservation.
Right, yeah, and that's another point I really want to make is that the playing cards are only one product in a suite of products that go from, well, the cards themselves are individualized and kind of informal. Then we have the informational website. But then beyond that, Dr. Rush has been instrumental in developing mock archaeological sites and actually constructing them at Fort Drum. So these would be mock archaeological ruins, Muslim cemeteries, things that they would encounter routinely in Iraq or Afghanistan.
The cards that we were talking about, the playing cards, have been handed out earlier this month. Have you gotten any reaction?
Yes, it's been uniformly positive from the soldiers themselves. We've gotten really good responses from the troops that are over in Iraq right now saying, well, like everybody says, gee, I wish we had these a while back. These are great.
Yeah. Well, but better late than never.
Well, I just want to mention one thing, if I could. You'll notice every card mentions ROE first up at the top. That has to do with rules of engagement. Well, we're not suggesting that the troops in any way or shape risk their life to protect these resources. They must always follow rules of engagement first in terms of how they engage the enemy and how they protect themselves. And so that's why every card mentions that.
Jim Zeidler is senior research scientist at the Center for Environmental Management of Military Lands at Colorado State University, based at Fort Collins. He worked with a graphic designer to create a new deck of cultural and historic playing cards for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Jim, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, in 1 minute, we'll have new work from Rick Moody. That's coming up here and now. Writer Rick Moody won widespread acclaim for his book The Ice Storm, which portrayed affluent New York suburbs as metaphoric wastelands. But in his new collection of novellas of post-9/11 anxiety, That Wasteland is real. In the story, the Albertine notes, a dirty bomb has devastated Manhattan and vaporized 4 million people, and the survivors search for anything to remedy the bleakness of their existence. Reporter Kevin Lee digs around for a street drug named Albertine. There's a cost to Albertine, but in the beginning, it is a glorious trip to past memory.
So the thing with Albertine was that at night, under its influence, you remembered. Tonight the past was glorious and indelible. Serena in the park with the rum and the bittersweet revelation of her boyfriend. Tonight was the beauty of almost being in love, which was a great beauty. But tomorrow, your memory was full of holes. Not a blackout, more like a brownout.
Author Rick Moody reading from the Albertine Notes, one of three novellas in his new work, Right Livelihoods, and he joins us now from the Argo Network in New York City. Rick, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
New York City destroyed by a bomb blast. I'm thinking there's a lot of New Yorkers who, you know, this might be unbearable. What made you dig into this?
You know, when I started, it was in that period after 9/11 when a lot of American writers were sort of thinking that they were ready to deal with that material. And I had this sort of resistance to trying to write about it. I felt like we hadn't contextualized it yet. But then this story kind of exploded out sideways. And I think what it does is recognize that you don't get to choose your material entirely. I may think I don't want to write about 9/11 yet, but 9/11 might want to kind of articulate itself through me somewhat.
Well, let's talk about some of the characters. Your protagonist, a third-generation Chinese-American. His parents, he says, weren't grocers but an IT tycoon and a microbiologist. First of all, why did you choose to write in the voice of a Chinese-American, Kevin Lee?
One thing I imagined by choosing a Chinese-American kid is that there's some relationship to the very stiff, waspy culture that I was reared in the New England suburbs. Mm-hmm. There's a similarity between it and the kind of dignity and rectitude that I see in Chinese culture. So it's often the case that no matter how heavy your heart is in sort of WASP culture, you have trouble talking about it, and that's maybe something that other cultures can relate to well.
Well, and in this case, it gets stripped away. I mean, the dignity part. Character, Kevin Lee, lives in a supply closet in a big old armory with all these other, you know, walking wounded around him. And by the way, how much is also post-Katrina here? Because, well, actually, how much is post-Katrina? How much is, you know, your own, you've written about your own struggles with alcohol, a brief stay in a mental health institution. I'm feeling like I'm feeling all of this in here.
Certainly the addiction theme is very native to me, and I did have experience with it, which I regret. But the Katrina part of it's completely coincidental. This was actually written before Katrina.
Interesting, because it's that sort of hallucinatory, you know, scene that we saw, Katrina, times about 1,000. Tell us more about this drug, Albertine, that everyone in this post-apocalypse New York is trying to get.
In the context of the story, the drug enables people to have absolutely perfect recall of their memories and to experience the memories as though they were happening anew. And since everyone in the story is a survivor of this very destructive, gigantic bomb blast in Lower Manhattan, they're all attracted to the memories that predate that calamity.
So there's the intoxicating smell of fresh mown grass, the sound of yellow jackets trying to get in through the screen. These are some of the things that your character remembers. But of course, the next day it's worse. You feel worse.
They start to forget after they take the drug too often. Their regular daily memories get effaced and so forth, which is very much like my experience of addiction, frankly. Yeah.
So this story, is it, as all the reviewers are saying, science fiction? Or is it really your vision of, you know, what it truly might be post an apocalypse? Is it meant to be real? What is it?
No, not at all. I mean, initially, Michael Chabon, you know, the great novelist, was making this anthology where he was trying to get writers, so-called literary writers, to write so-called genre fictions. And I said, oh, I'll try and write a science fiction story. But it turns out that I don't have those kinds of muscles, you know. So I think in the end, even though there are some veneer of science fiction in this story. What was of interest to me as a literary writer is Kevin and Kevin's psychology. You know, this is a very weird first-person narrator. There's a lot of doubling back in his mind in time and space and so forth. And that, to me, is a kind of characterization that we associate with, you know, novels past, the kind that we keep on reading.
Well, and it's also associated with the mentally ill or the addict. So you can never tell if in fact, you know, when he goes back in time and all this, if it's just, you know, what it is, you know, what it is as you read it. He goes at one point to see, you know, the devastated Manhattan. I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit of what he sees or doesn't see, because he sees what's been bombed away.
The former CBGB, New York University is gone. Zeckendorf Towers, gone. Union Square Park is gone. The building where Andy Warhol's factory once was. What used to be Max's Kansas City. And the Empire State Building is gone, which, when it fell sideways, crushed a huge chunk of Lower Fifth Avenue all the way to the Flatiron District.
It's enough that the trade towers are gone. But to think further of the, you know, other things being gone, it's kind of tough.
I agree. I mean, I, not to overstate the case, but I did an interview not too long ago, or I was on the radio show of this great New York disc jockey called Vin Scelsa, and he actually read this passage out loud because he likes to read from the books. Mm-hmm. And it was actually really painful to me hearing it. I mean, I actually sort of, well, I got kind of emotional about it. I'll tell you, in truth, Robin, it derives from a single moment of the 9/11 experience, which is I was trapped in Washington that day, and my wife, who worked downtown, had to flee across the Brooklyn Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it was a really, I think, devastating experience for her, of course. And after that, we became sort of obsessed with nervousness about the Brooklyn Bridge. It became sort of the thing that we couldn't bear to lose, you know? And I think in a way, our, my 9/11 anxiety in the weeks afterwards had to do with, you know, whatever happens, we have to save the Brooklyn Bridge, you know? And I think this passage in the story is an attempt to try to think through what it really means and to really kind of see the city and prize the city while we have it. I mean, it wants to make us do that, that passage. Mm.
Rick Moody, we're speaking of his new work, Right Livelihoods, and one of the novellas in that collection, The Albertine Notes. And by the way, Right Livelihoods?
It's an old Buddhist edict. You know, there's a whole bunch of kind of suggestions in Buddhism, and one of them is that you should practice right livelihoods, which just means, you know, a vocation that's pleasing to you somehow.
It's funny, though, because some critics thought you meant right livelihoods, neighborhoods.
Well, that's fine. I'll take all the possible interpretations.
Rick, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.